We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
And joining us now is the author of The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. Dr. Sherrod, thank you so much for coming on to KMOX.
A pleasure.
That's an interesting book title. You know, what's wrong with jury trials? And how about we start there? Why do you have a fascination with jury trials? And why did you decide to write a book about it?
My fascination stems from the fact that I've been a jury consultant for 30 years. And we've worked on hundreds of cases, big cases. Usually we did civil trials, so lots of money was at stake, millions and millions of dollars, a couple of billion in some cases. And basically the whole trial would be staged in advance. We would anticipate likely outcomes, determine the best kind of questions for selecting a jury, the most persuasive arguments, and then do post-trial jury interviews.
Wow.
So I know how juries work pretty well. And being a social psychologist, I've taught courses on jury behavior.
You know, wasn't Dr. Phil from television fame doing something similar to that?
He was.
Yeah.
And the show Bull is based on Dr. Phil's life.
Yeah.
Dr. Phil was Oprah's clinical psychologist, and Oprah got sued by the Texas Beef Council for criticizing beef. And he went down to West Texas to help select a jury for Oprah.
So how good are you at this whole process? Would you consider yourself someone that could always pick up on the tells? Were you someone that was just so into nuance of people that you'd pick up on things that no one else would pick up on?
Well, that's kind of an illusion that there are tells which you can use to decide how a juror will react. Mm. There's not much research to say that body language predicts verdict, or that anything about the way a person walks into the jury or crosses their arms or anything like that. What you really need to do is use a questionnaire, ask lots of questions, know exactly how the juror feels about the issue in the case in terms of their life experience, their beliefs, attitudes, values. Only then can you predict what a juror is likely to decide, because basically you already know in advance how they feel about something very similar to the case.
Yeah. So when you meet someone for the first time, or let's say you're at a family function and they, you know, introduce you to someone new, does this, I got to imagine this always comes up at least once. You're trying to analyze me right now, aren't you? That's almost
people
a guarantee.
The okay. Other question I get is, I just got called for jury duty. How can I get off?
Do you have a good answer to that?
Well, I don't tell them because I believe jury duty is important and ennobling.
Mm, okay. The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with the Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. Dr. Sherrod joins us on KMOX. So let's talk about the whole process in itself. When you look at it from an insider's view, you've seen it from behind the scenes. What's wrong with the jury trials?
This may be shocking, but the real problem with jury trials is that we are witnessing the death of trial by jury in America.
Hmm.
A phenomenon is called the vanishing jury, or the disappearing jury. The statistics are kind of shocking. Only 0.5% of all the civil trials filed in a year goes to a jury. 0.5%. And for criminal trials, it's virtually the same. It's about 1.5% of all the criminal trials filed in a year go to a jury.
Mm-hmm.
So the jury is in the Sixth and Seventh Amendment to the Constitutions. We're guaranteed trial by jury. It's part of the significant amendments to the Constitution, and yet we're letting it evaporate. We're letting it vanish. And not many people are making a complaint about it.
Hmm. You know, we've had a couple of high-profile grand juries. There's actually a grand jury now that's currently looking into our prosecutor here in St. Louis. Is there a difference between trial juries and grand juries?
I think they both represent a cross-section of the community, and that's the goal.
Yeah.
And at least in the regular juries, that's part of the problem, that actually so few people actually get their summons or follow through on the summons that the juries are not very representative of the community or the community standards. That's a problem that needs to be resolved.
Have you been called for jury duty?
Yes, I was called for jury duty, and it was a very interesting experience. I was actually in the panel. The jury was selected, and I was still, and it had a low number, and I was in the group that was being question about whether or not we could be an alternate to the jury.
Mm.
And very interestingly, the prosecuting attorney went down each of the potential alternate jurors and said, can you promise me you'll keep an open mind and not make up your mind till you've heard all the evidence? Everyone says, yes, ma'am, absolutely, yes, ma'am. She got to me, and I kind of did that face where you shake your head back and forth and sort of I look uncertain. And she pointed to me, and she said, what does that mean? And I said, I thought to myself, well, you asked. So I told her that the research shows that most jurors make up their mind during the opening statements before they've even heard any of the evidence. And then that guides what they attend to during the case in chief. At that point, she threw up her hand, swept around, faced the jurors, and she said, ignore everything that man is telling you. Just ignore everything he's saying. And then a few months later, she gave me this big fake smile, and she said, we thank and excuse Mr. Sheriff.
Oh, man. You said months later? Or minutes later?
Minutes later.
I was going to say months. The only time, I've actually been called for jury duty a few times. There was one time where I actually got selected. I sat in the, and saw the whole trial go on. It was a case of, is this guy, I think, closed a car door and it caught a woman's arm and she got dragged behind and she was suing him. Mm. And I got all the way to the end and she said, well, we always keep an extra juror around just in case someone drops out. So I'm going to pull the name out of a fish bowl and whoever gets picked doesn't get to go behind and, place a verdict. So I got my name pulled. I went through the whole process. I didn't even get to go to the end where I get to say guilty or not guilty or whatever. Missed out on the fun part. Sat through the whole thing.
Did you have to sit through the trial, though?
I had to sit through the whole trial. I sat through the whole thing. I was paying attention. I was really diligent. And I, took all this time, of course, to do this. And I thought, wow, I'm gonna make the most of my first experience serving on a jury. And nope, got pulled right out of the end, right out of the fishbowl. Didn't even get
to the... Did you find the trial interesting? Could you understand the evidence? Was it clearly presented?
Yeah, I could. There's little things that were distracting to me. So this was kind of a small courtroom, and one of the lawyers had, his little collar was frayed a little, and it was very distracting
to me.
So, and they would bring up questions and lines of questioning, and I understood where he was going, and it was kind of fun to observe that sort of thing and kind of figure that sort of thing out. But there was these little distracting things that took you out of the moment sometimes.
Right.
And then
let me just talk about why. What's wrong with what's happening with juries and what's wrong with them?
Yeah,
because there are so few jury trials to start off with, and the reason for that is most criminal trials have been replaced by plea bargaining. Where an accused person admits to a lesser crime in order to have a lighter sentence. But the reason they do that is they don't trust juries. They think the jury could award me many more years in prison than I could get if I plea bargained. And a similar thing happens with civil trials, where corporations sue each other or a person sues a corporation. Most civil trials settle are dismissed in settlement. For example, I've been in so many cases and trials where we've selected a jury, we're sitting, we're waiting for the opening statements to be presented. One attorney says, Your Honor, may I approach the bench? Both attorneys scurry up to the bench. The judge covers the mic with his hand. They whisper. Then they shake hands, and the judge announces that the trial is over. And the jurors are dismissed, that it just settled. Mm-hmm. And that happens over and over and over. And there, too, the reason is to avoid having to go before a jury because juries are mistrusted. Mm-hmm. Also, most of the contracts we sign, for example, if you ever look at your cell phone contract, at some point it's going to say you, in any dispute, you waive your right to trial by jury and agree to binding arbitration.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true for a gym membership, if you hire a home remodeling person, if you send a loved one to a nursing home, mm-hmm. you almost always waive your right to trial by jury. So trial by jury is being essentially waived out of existence. The question is, should we allow it?
The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. That's the book from Dr. Jury Sherrod. You can find out more on his website, thejurycrisis.com. We'll continue our conversation with him. We'll ask him about his conclusions, how he believes the jury process could be saved. Coming up next on Overnight America, KMOX.
News at the top and bottom of the hour. Mornings and afternoons. KMOX.
Welcome back to Overnight America. Our guest this hour, Dr. Drew Sherrod. He has a book called The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. One of his big concerns is that jury trials are being waived out of existence. And he explained how a lot of times it's either settled out of court or you find that when you sign a contract, they always want to try to mediate the process. That's the thing. Isn't there some sort of federal protection in some of these cases where even though it might be written into a contract, there's still the availability for a person to take this to trial?
I think it's a legal conflict, and some lawyers would say, no, there's still you can still argue your way into having trial by jury. Mm-hmm. But so many people, I think, are happy to have a mediator because they don't trust the jury trial either. So yeah. Basically, the jury trial is so mistrusted. And so this is I think, where we get to the interesting point. The question is, whose fault is it that the jury trial is so mistrusted? Is it juries because they're can be easily ridiculed, demeaned, dismissed, denigrated, arrive at ridiculous verdicts? Or is it judges, lawyers, law schools, court systems who assume that the brain is capable of more than it's capable of?
Hmm. Interesting. The book's called The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with the Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. Dr. Sherrod joining us here on KMOX. I always had the impression that a lot of times lawyers prefer to just settle out of court because, you know, they got a backlog and they got other things to do, and it's a lot easier than actually taking something to trial, as opposed to them thinking that there could be a jury that would be difficult for them to work with.
It kind of depends on the difference. I think plaintiff jurors, you know, who make their money by winning a huge verdict and taking a third of it, that's how they become rich. Plaintiff lawyers. Defense lawyers actually succeed by staying out of court, by billing lots of hours, by doing lots of discovery, by submitting lots of motions, and then the case settles. So I think it depends on whether it's a defense lawyer or a plaintiff's lawyer.
Yeah. Who would be a perfect juror?
Well, that depends on the case.
Yeah?
I think we've done so much research, you really can't say a perfect juror across regions, cities, venues, states, or across types of cases, that different types of people have had different experiences. And also, another interesting thing is you can actually say if you have a car crash where a car is, you're alleging the design was unsafe, the kind of people who will, people appraise risk differently. That's the important point. They appraise risk differently. So that, for example, if you look at gender and ethnicity, old rich white guys are not going to be very concerned about risk because they think, I've always taken care of myself. You know, I'm going to get through this. Life goes pretty well for me. Whereas young, poor, minority women will have had a life experience where things roll over them and hurt them all the time. And they are all often deprived of the ability to the social power to protect themselves.
Mm.
So the old rich white guys might be exactly right for one kind of trial. And then, say, an assault or criminal trial, the young, poor women might be different because they can understand what's going on.
Yeah. You ever see these stories and they pop up every once in a while where someone says, or at least they go back and they review the evidence, or they have DNA technology now and they find out someone that may have been found guilty by a jury was actually innocent. And sometimes, you know, the guilt of the people on the jury, they feel like, I can't believe we got this wrong. Do you ever see those type of stories and wonder what could have went wrong maybe in jury selection or how they were persuaded in something that may not have been actual, something that should have convicted a person?
Well, I think you can go back to the point I just made, that different kinds of people see the evidence differently, and they actually see it differently. So the question is there an absolutely right kind of evidence out there, or is evidence just sort of socially appraised differently by different people?
Hmm.
In that Trayvon Martin case, which happened about 5 years ago, I think, where a young African-American teenager was visiting his dad and his dad's girlfriend in Florida at a condo, and he left to go to the 7-Eleven on a rainy night and sort of going back and forth under cover of porches to avoid the rain. And a neighborhood watch committee guy saw him and thought he looked suspicious. And he called the police and said, I think there's something suspicious going on. He just robbed this kid. Police said, leave it to us. But the guy went to follow him anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up having a scuffle, and no one saw this. The evidence is unclear what happened, but the kid ended up being shot and he died.
Mm-hmm.
And the Neighborhood Watch Committee guy was acquitted.
Right. Very famous.
So afterwards, and so the people on the jury, there were a number of people on the jury who had lots of familiarity with Neighborhood Watch Committees. Their husbands were on Neighborhood Watch Committee. They owned firearms. They went to firearm ranges. And so they were kind of suited to know, suited to be hooked by an argument that here was a suspicious young man going in and out of porches near apartments. And they would be primed to hook on that argument and think, I might have been afraid if that kid approached me. I might have used self-defense also.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be the kind of thing after the fact people might regret, but the evidence wasn't really that clear. It was based on the story I told about the evidence.
And stand your ground became a big topic of discussion after that. No one really knew what that was up until that case. Well, at least it wasn't in the national discussion until then. So sometimes
stand your ground became an invitation for juries to tell stories. In fact, it said, I don't remember the exact language, but it was, if you can put yourself in the defendant's shoes, would you have felt enough danger that it would justify self-defense, fighting in self-defense?
Mm-hmm. Would you continue your services after a jury is selected, or do you kind of move on after that?
We will often have written an opening statement, and the opening statement would be organized around a number of themes. Essentially, the opening statement, instead of being the kind of opening statement that most lawyers use, where it's a list of sort of a pad of points they just check off on a yellow pad, it would be a narrative story. So we would always write an opening statement and a narrative story with beginning, middle, and end that organized the evidence in such a way that it was much easier for jurors to recommend.
Mm-hmm.
So then we would often be present for the opening statements so we could revise or help out in a similar future case. So we would often do post-trial jury interviews. Anyway, yes, sir.
Oh, post-trial interviews. So what would you get from that?
Fascinating information. Often, frequently, we get jurors admitting that they would spend a couple of hours with, say, half the jurors. And they would admit they often didn't understand the evidence, really had no idea what it was about. There was one drug case where one of the jurors said, I'm not a scientist. I'm as blue-collar as you can get. I had no idea what this medical evidence was about. But it seemed to me that the company was guilty because the day after the person took this drug, she got sick. So basically, that's one simple little story fact. Someone takes a drug, gets sick the next day, looks like the drug caused it.
Interesting.
Whereas, in fact, they had a week or so of science about how the drug allegedly failed.
The perception of it all, how powerful that is.
Right.
Well, how long have you actually been doing this for?
30 years.
30 years. So I'm trying to date that back. Were you doing this back when the O.J. trial was going on?
I was just starting.
Yeah.
And, in fact, I live in L.A., and I talked to lots of people about the O.J. trial.
Mm-hmm. You had to have. I mean, that's kind of seems like the gold standard when it comes to juries anymore when you talk about this sort of topic and how you would analyze.
In fact, I told them it would be acquittal by noon because I think something like 85% of black people across America thought that he was innocent, mm-hmm. and the trial had 8 black people.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was pretty easy to go from the national statistics polls to the jury trial. And then and then when it was justified by saying that that the LAPD had a racist policeman who had tricked the evidence, it wasn't very hard to tell people, it's going to be acquittal by noon, and it was.
Yeah. It's Dr. Sherrod, The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. If someone wants to check out your book or maybe more about what you're doing, where can they find you?
I have a web page, and it's called thejurycrisis.com. That tells about the book, and it has a box you can click to order the book.
Thejurycrisis.com, the info all there where you can find a copy of the book, where you can get your hands on it. So really, how can you save the jury process?
The real answer there is that we have to view jury trials as contests of stories instead of an opportunity to present lots of evidence. Because the brain really looks for stories instead of evidence. The brain is more interested in stories than evidence. So if we present trials as evidence, it pretty much just passes over the brain. Like the guy whose example I gave for that medical trial. He said, I really didn't understand the science. I'm as blue-collar as you can get. So the trials, the information has to be, jury selection has to be based on storytellers. The case-in-chief has to be based around telling a story which organizes the evidence, beginning, middle, and end. Sets up little mental file folders for jurors to use as they try to remember during deliberations.
Mm-hmm.
And then deliberations are about the stories juries tell, and juries can be educated in how they can use facts to check their stories.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, switching the emphasis from evidence to stories. Stories trump evidence.
Mm. That's interesting. You get that emotional connection with someone, that's pretty powerful. That storytelling can do that.
It can.
Yeah.
It's triggered because the brain evolved to work that way. very important book called Thinking Fast and Slow that says we evolved to do fast, intuitive, instinctual, make decisions that way, and not slow, statistical, analytical explanations.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, on a side note, I really like the design cover of your book. I think it's beautifully designed, and I'm looking at your website now, thejurycrisis.com. You're an intimidating-looking guy. I can imagine you trying to analyze some people. Very intimidating.
It's a strange picture. Friends have commented on it, and some say, you look mean, and others say, you look sexy. So I'll accept sexy over mean.
Yeah, that's a stern look you got there. I don't know what the photographer told you to think about, but whatever it was, it worked.
Well, I think it looks authoritative, so it's good for the book.
Dr. Jury Sherrod, the book again, The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with the Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. Thank you so much for coming on to KMOX.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, and he joins us on the Quiver River Electric guest line. You know, I was going to do this interview in the last hour, but we ran a little bit long. What don't you know about heart disease that could be a big problem? And maybe you're not asking the question with your doctor. Maybe you're ignoring the symptoms. But apparently they did this national survey, and it turns out a lot of people are not so smart when it comes to their own health and heart disease, because there's a lot of misconceptions about it. So let's talk to a doctor about that. Andrea Clemis is going to join us next. Overnight America, KMOX.
Keeping you up and making you think. This is Overnight America with Ryan Recker on KMOX.
And joining us now is the Chief Medical Officer for MDVIP, Dr. Andrea Clemis. Thank you so much for coming on to KMOX.
Thank you for having me.
It wasn't just, oh, I don't know, 2 years ago or so, I did a quick Google search for your name, and I wanted to see some videos of interviews you've done. And the first thing that came up was a Fox 2 interview for here in St. Louis. I don't know why that may be one of your more popular ones. But You're someone that's always talking to people about different medical topics. And this one, there's a recent survey, the Heart Attack IQ Quiz. There's some interesting findings about that. And thank you so much for coming on to talk about it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So part of this survey shows that Americans don't really know their facts when it comes to heart disease. Why do you think that is? Why do you think there's so much misinformation about that out there, too?
You know, I think we've done a good job in the medical field of educating about cholesterol. But there's a lot more to heart disease. And if I can just step back a second, put it in perspective, imagine if four jumbo jets crashed every day for a year and killed everyone on board. Mm. There'd be a big outcry, right? Everybody would be yelling and screaming and saying, what should we do? Well, that's how many people die of heart disease every year. And over 80% of those deaths are preventable. So that's why MDVIP did this survey, so that we could really understand what Americans know about heart disease and then be able to help educate on the missing pieces.
So what are those things people think they know about heart disease that's actually not true?
Well, most of them, the good part was some of them knew that, a lot of them knew that heart disease is the leading killer. Mm-hmm. Many of them said that they knew what their risk was for heart disease, and over half felt they were doing enough. But 62% failed the quiz. Some of those things that they got wrong. One of the things is that many people believe that cholesterol is everything. Mm-hmm. And I think the medical field and the media have done a great job educating on cholesterol. But there's another piece of the puzzle, and that's inflammation. Mm. Over half the heart attacks happen in patients with a normal cholesterol. And so many people got wrong, how can a heart attack really happen? It doesn't happen when the cholesterol just builds up in the artery and blocks it. It happens because, just like when you have an infection, the cholesterol is foreign in our body, and the body sends out cells to try and wall it off. Mm-hmm. If that wall ruptures, just like you cut yourself shaving, you know, you get a blood clot there. Well, when that wall ruptures, you get a blood clot in your artery, and it clogs the artery.
Hmm.
And most people just didn't know that.
Interesting. Well, I didn't know that. I mean, there's a lot of things people don't know. You know, and they, what happens when they go to the doctor, too? I was kind of surprised to learn that, for the most part, men are better than women when asking doctors the questions about these sort of things.
Yeah, I think that's because many women are protected from heart disease before menopause, so I don't think they think about it until when you're worrying about prevention, you're older, and it's a little bit too late. Mm. And I think, you know, historically, a lot of people think of heart disease as a man's disease. although women are more apt to die from the first heart attack.
Oh, interesting. I do think of it as a man's disease. Honestly, when I was thinking back about heart attacks, the first thing that always comes into mind, it's always men. You don't, for me at least, experience a lot of stories about women having this sort of thing. So, yeah, that's one of those myths that need to be broken.
Right. And, I mean, heart disease kills men and women equally. So, and it is the number one killer. More people will die from heart disease than all cancers combined. Yet, the MDVIP survey showed people are more afraid of cancer than of heart disease.
Mm. Dr. Andrea Clemes joining us here on KMOX, the recent heart attack IQ quiz. So what are those things that people should be doing? What are those things that people should be asking their doctors in order to make sure they're taking care of their health properly?
Well, they need to find a doctor who they can really partner with and who understands this. Asking about what's their, not only their cholesterol number, but what are their cholesterol particle numbers and size? And do they know about their chronic inflammation status? Like, do they have chronic inflammation or not? These are things that a knowledgeable primary care physician, like in the MDVIP network, who has the time to sit down and go through this with you, they know what tests to do to understand, do you have inflammation? Is your cholesterol bad? Do you have the heart attack gene? You know, do you have the genetics that are going to predispose you to a heart attack? So you need to know all of those things to be able to work with your physician to make a plan to mitigate them.
Mm. When you say inflammation, chronic inflammation, is there a certain age that you start asking these questions? Or does it really, like you say, normally people over the age of 50 should be more concerned about this than, you know, 40 or something like that?
Actually, most of the deaths from heart disease happen in people under the age of 65.
Okay. Yeah.
And so it's really, you know, your 20s, your 30s, you need to be thinking about these things, know your family history. And a lot of it is your lifestyle. You know, if you smoke, you know, you're going to be much more apt to have heart disease at a much younger age. If you have diabetes, in fact, you know, I said before, women are protected against heart disease premenopause, but not if they're diabetic.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 out of 3 diabetic patients will die of heart disease.
Mm. Dr. Andrea Clemes joining us, Chief Medical Officer for MDVIP. So the way that we treat this sort of thing in 2019 and moving on, is there been some pretty big medical advancements? Are people better off now than they were, let's say, 10 years ago?
I think they are better off. We do know a lot more, and I think one of the things many physicians should know and is that lifestyle changes can actually prevent a lot of this disease.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all those things that, you know, people don't want to work so hard at sometimes, but that's diet, that's exercise, that's stress relief, that's sleeping well. If you can get a handle on all of that, a lot of times you won't even need medication.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do need the medications, yes, there are more classes of drugs to be able to decrease the cholesterol and decrease the chronic inflammation.
Diet, exercise, sleeping well, those are some pretty solid keys there. What's like the right amount of exercising, really?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you can handle, but you know, you need to be able to exercise 3 to 4 days a week and making sure that you're actually exercising, some vigorous exercise. But, you know, everybody's different. I have bad knees and can't run, so I have to do more, you know, weight training and other things. It's just, it's one of the things I've always found with patients is if you find an exercise you like, you'll actually be more apt to do it.
Huh.
That's probably the most important thing is as long as you keep exercising.
Is there anything else you looked at in this survey that you found interesting?
Yeah, I think that it was interesting that less than half of the patients, like less than 40%, have ever asked their primary care physicians about heart disease or have gotten advice from their primary care physicians about what they can do about their risk for heart disease. And primary care physicians are the best way to prevent heart disease because they're the ones who can work with you early to identify all of these risks.
Yeah.
And I think one of the other things that was surprising too was that people don't really understand about fats, you know, that there are some good fats that can actually help you prevent heart attacks. So fat like that's in salmon or nuts. there is, I don't want to ruin any of the questions on the quiz, but there was one that said, what's worse for you, a medium French fry, a 3-ounce filet mignon, a scrambled egg, or a cup of ice cream?
Oh, wow. Well, I know which one I would answer. I would answer the French fries, but I don't know if I'd be wrong on that. But I got to take
wrong,
the quiz, I
that
guess.
Is what, that, you need to take the quiz, but that is what most people answered, because the saturated fat and ice cream is worse for you than any of those other foods.
Really?
So those are the sort of things you can learn if you go take the quiz.
You know, that's interesting. How many questions is the quiz? And if people wanted to take it, where can they find it at?
It's 25, 30 questions, and you can find it at mdvip.com/heartattackIQ.
Gotcha.
And after you take it, you'll get the right answers, so you'll get to learn, and you'll get some tools, things that you can take with you to your physician so that you can ask questions about your risk for heart attack.
So how long have you been in the medical field?
Oh, do I have to tell you? A lady's not supposed to tell her age.
Enough, yeah.
Over 30 years.
Oh, okay. So anytime there's a television show or a movie that follows some sort of happenings inside of a hospital or a doctor's office, are you drawn to those sort of forms of entertainment, or do you look at that and say, this is so unrealistic, kind of like the survey, and you're like, there's so many things that are wrong with this, I can't even watch it. It spoils it for you.
You know, I'm probably a little bit more of the first. I grew up on ER and General Hospital, which, of course, is a soap opera.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was a big follower of ER and a lot of those shows back in the day, because that was what I knew. That was what I lived.
Dr. House was a popular one there for a while. You know, really popular online on YouTube and places like that are doctors or lawyers or whatever it is. They'll actually watch some of those television shows and they'll give their opinion on how accurate they are. Mm-hmm. And it's funny to see how much liberty some of these television shows give to the facts or whatnot, just for the entertainment factor of how to make the television show work.
They do, although I do know I've had some friends who were physicians out in California, and they do consult with physicians sometimes to try and make it as realistic as possible.
Dr. Andrea Clemes, and again, the website, if people want to take the survey for themselves, where can they find it?
mdvip.com/heartattackIQ.
mdvip.com/heartattackIQ. It's the Heart Attack IQ quiz. Find it online. Take it for yourself. Learn something important for you or a family member. Dr. Andrea Clemes, thank you so much for coming on to KMOX.
Thanks for having me, and stay warm up there.
Oh, thanks. She's down in Miami. Stay warm. Thanks. You hear that one. She joins us on the Quiver River Electric guest line. I just had a little debate with producer Mike, and I'm going to open up the text line. I want you to decide who's right. How do you slice a sandwich? Is it corner to corner or up and down? What's the best way? Seriously. 314-436-7900. It's Overnight America, KMOX.
Now, more of Overnight America with Ryan Recker on KMOX.
I want to describe to you something that just happened here at the KMOX studio. So I'm in the studio. I'm alone. I have all of this space to myself. It's glorious. You know, all the other shows, they have all kinds of other people around them, but here through the late night hours, it's just me and you, or you and me, or, you know, whatever. We're coast to coast. We're border to border, and we're connecting you through the late night hours. So we had a little disagreement. Producer Mike's in the other producer booth. We're separated by soundproof glass, which we experimented that we can actually scream in our own studios and hear each other through the soundproof glass just a little bit. And then we wondered, you know, what can the neighbors above us that, because, you know, in the way we're situated in the Park Pacific building, the three floors on the bottom are just commercial. And then the floors above it up till like 22, it's residential. So there we are, screaming at each other through the soundproof glass to see what happens. And yes, we can hear each other through it. Earlier today, I drove through, I got some Chinese food, and I'm still pretty full. And normally, I bring a snack for myself to eat, so I'm not too hungry at night. And I'll take a little snack before it's time. And my snack today was a peanut butter and jelly sandwich made with what I think one of the most underrated jellies, blueberry jelly. Welch's blueberry jelly is so good. And I extended an invitation to producer Mike and said, you know, I'm not going to eat it. I'm not hungry. Would you like the sandwich? He said, sure. So I handed it over to him, and he said one of the weirdest things I have ever heard him say. Why didn't you cut this thing corner to corner? Because it's peanut butter and jelly. It's a sandwich. You cut it down the middle. You don't cut a peanut butter and jelly corner to corner and have two wedges. That's only you're allowed to do that for grilled cheese. That's it.
I just thought it was classier.
It's not. What do you, it's finger food. Like you're eating little cucumber sandwiches and things. You get your pinky finger up. It's like a special cocktail
are you
dinner.
Dissing cucumber sandwiches?
Yeah, I am. But that's the only ones you're allowed to cut diagonally, corner to corner.
Someone's on hold that's going to have a bone to pick with you.
Any sandwich, in particular, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, you can only cut it one way, right down the middle. If you don't cut it down the middle, the only other acceptable way is no cutting at all. The side-to-side stuff, you save that for the grilled cheese.
No side-to-side. Corner to corner.
Corner to corner, same thing.
Yeah, diagonal. A diagonal cut.
Blasphemous. You can't cut it diagonal. A peanut butter and jelly? Imagine I send my kid to school with the peanut butter and jelly cut that way. He's going to get made fun of for the rest of his life.
No, he's not.
No one cuts it
that way.
They're
probably going to move him up a grade.
Because he's so smart?
Yeah.
For cutting it that way?
Look at how classy Emmett is.
Oh, he is very classy. Did you like the blueberry jelly?
Delicious.
Isn't it awesome?
Delicious.
When my wife found that in the store, she said, I'm going to give it a try. I won't buy anything else after that. I love that jam so much. Ah, blueberry jelly. All right, so who's right here? You know, corner to corner or up and down on a peanut butter and jelly, honestly. 314-436-7900. You said Mike's calling in. Hey, Mike.
Sandwich, well, that can be debated. Now, I'm going to tell me personally, mm-hmm. I cut straight down the middle. I ain't going to kid you. But a lot of times it ends up on a corner, and I won't mention this person's name because it's not too. But sometimes some people say it depends on what kind of mood you're in.
What kind of but mood me, you're in? Why would your mood change the way you cut the sandwich?
Well, some people say if they cut it straight down the middle, and sometimes if they don't feel like it, they just cut it from corner to corner.
I don't get it. I don't know how you would be able to change your preference based on your mood. I don't get that either.
Well, it's a sandwich because I work in a restaurant and I'm a culinary man. Think about this. If you cut it straight down in the middle and you put it in a plate, a lot of your sandwiches are going to look like they've been cut from the corner.
Uh-huh.
But either way, I guess that's a waste of argument. It's fun to say that if you take a poll. But me personally, now this is me. If I was eating a jelly sandwich, I would have cut straight down the middle and eat it.
Because there's only one way. That's the only acceptable way when there's jelly involved. Down the middle.
I would say that's the only way. But can I ask you something to get off the subject? Very important to me. You know how bad this weather is?
Yeah.
And it's snow. And I'd like to say this if you don't mind me saying.
Yeah.
I think people ought to salute these cab drivers that have been out there, Laclee, and getting these people where they need to go. They've been really professional about it.
Oh, that's awesome.
It might be expensive, but they do a fantastic job when you need them. I think they deserve some praise.
Okay, you don't hear much love for the taxi driver, the cab driver. Okay, no problem. Thanks, Mike.
Bye-bye.
All right, let me go to Ellen real quick in West County. Ellen, what's going on?
Hey, okay, here's the definitive answer.
Mm-hmm.
The diagonal cut allows you to control the jelly sliding toward the bottom of the sandwich much better.
Wait, what do you mean? No.
Pardon me?
Well, how about this? When you cut diagonally, what if there's a larger concentration of jelly in the middle? It's just going to pop right out.
Well, you have to ask yourself who made the sandwich and who cannot spread evenly.
But you think going diagonally reduces the risk of it falling out?
Yeah.
How?
Okay. I'm right-handed, so normally I eat a sandwich with my left hand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the point is facing toward your palm.
Mm-hmm.
If you spread your first and fourth fingers, you've got control of all three corners.
Yeah. All three corners. So it's like a knuckleball you're holding, like just playing baseball.
It's not that hard. You hold the phone the same way, for heaven's sake.
I know, but I can't imagine you get... What you're doing is, even though
you're
it's the same amount
the
of...
You're not holding the sandwich to your ear.
No, but even though you have the same amount of crust, you cut it diagonally, you're basically only getting a little bit of that middle part without the crust. Then everything else is crust bite. It's when you do it diagonally.
There is that aesthetic argument... But jelly control is extremely important when you're eating one-handed.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Hey, thank you, Ellen. Bye.
You have a good night.
You too. Let's go to Todd. Todd, what's going on?
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Hey, the way I do my P&J is I put my P&J on one piece of bread and I fold it in half.
Oh, you're eating it like the poor man's hot dog bun.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, that's how I used to get hot dogs growing up. My parents never bought buns. It was always a folded over piece of bread. All right, so that holds it in pretty well then. Okay.
Yeah, works great.
Thanks, Todd. Bye.
All right, bye.
All right, real quick, let me get to Marianne. Hey, Marianne.
Yeah, hi, Ryan. I have to agree with Mike. I have always cut it diagonally.
What?
Since the beginning of time, I think it looks more appetizing.
Uh-huh. I don't believe it.
Yes. Oh, yes, it's true.
More appetizing.
Yes, it looks better. It tastes the same, maybe, but anyway, that's what I do.
All right, thanks, Marianne.
I love your show.
Thank you. Bye. All right, so producer Mike jumped into there and said, hey, guess what? That means I win. More people voted my way. I don't believe it. Fake news. Fake news.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.